BITCO is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. BITCO.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Hello? I know you're there. Look, I can see the lights of the TV. Please, I just want to watch the finale. Come on, guys, I'll give you a foot massage. Or anything.
Time to get your own fiber? Speak to Vox. Because for a limited time period, you can save up to 3,000 Rand in installation costs. And we'll send a technician to help you get set up.
Hello?
Go to vox.co.za. Get fiber to your home. Get free installation and activation. Open the door to endless entertainment.
T's and C's apply.
I'm Duncan McLeod and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm in Woodmead in Johannesburg today to talk to Ricardo Spanyi, also known as Fluffy Pony. Ricardo is a member of the Monero Core team, which stewards the Monero cryptocurrency project and is also the project's lead maintainer. Joining Ricardo is Naveen Jain. Is that how you pronounce your surname? Great. And he's co-founder of a new platform?
New protocol.
New protocol called Tari, which we're going to find out more about today. So welcome to the podcast, guys. Ricardo, let me start with you. And I have to ask this before I ask anything else. Why Fluffy Pony? Where does that come from?
So many moons ago, one of my first proper jobs was as a developer at an IT company. Mm-hmm. And there were these two girls who were known as Fluffy Puppy and Fluffy Bunny. Why they were known as that, I don't know. And at any rate, like, you know, due to copious amounts of office hijinks and silliness, I eventually got the nickname Fluffy Pony, and it stuck. You know, we started using it around the office. Skype was brand new, and I set Fluffy Pony as my Skype username.
Okay.
That was kind of a big deal. And it just sort of like, it was one of those things where after the silliness wore off, then the nickname like hung around, and I just couldn't shake it.
All right. And now you're wearing a t-shirt with a pony on it.
Well, yeah, you know, at some point you've got to embrace it, right?
Cool. So, Ricardo, the bio I received ahead of this interview says that you have an academic background in informatics and logistics and that you spent many years in software development. You now live with your wife on the garden route, and one of your hobbies is building and flying multi-copters. Is that a type of drone?
It's a drone, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's just that people who fly drones tend to not call them drones.
Right. Okay. How did that hobby come about?
So I've always loved building things. I've been playing with Lego for like 35 years, you know. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like building and flying multi-copters is just an extension of that. It's Lego with differently sized blocks. You know, there's a lot more soldering and fiddling around with software and, you know, dinky little settings and, oh, this cable runs there and, oh, I blew everything up and it shorted out. But it's just fun.
And do you build them from scratch?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I fly some commercial stuff as well. Well, not commercial, but, you know, stuff that you can buy as an end user that comes sort of ready built. But that's not as exciting as the stuff that you build yourself. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like in terms of the cost to performance and features benefit, it's also significantly better to build it yourself.
Do you sell them? Is it a business or just
no,
a hobby?
No, it's just a hobby.
How many have you built?
Oh, man. Sheesh. Including ones that have failed and ones that are in progress, probably like 35, 40.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's, you know, the thing is like you build it, you fly it, and then you're like, oh, I can pull this out and replace it with this. And then there was this whole like stage in my life where I decided to switch from one type of flight controller to another. I got obsessed with the Pixhawk and APM range of flight controllers. And so then I like went and pulled all the flight controllers out of all my drones and replaced them with APMs. And sort of, you know, like, does it really count as a new drone if you do that? I mean, it's the same drone, but, you know, you end up like pulling everything out and rewiring from scratch. So
right.
It's kind of new.
Yeah. What do you use them for? Photography or?
So I've used them for all sorts of things. My smaller ones are just for fun, flying around. I'm not particularly good at like acrobatics and racing. Mm-hmm. It's weird. It's not like the propellers are particularly expensive, but I'm always sort of a little bit nervous that I'm going to like clip a tree and lose a prop. And I think the guys that race and do acrobatics are amazing because they just like they move past that fear. And they're like, hey, no problem. I'm going to wreck this copter today. It happens.
Yeah.
And I haven't gotten to that point where I've moved past that fear yet. So I do a little bit of that, but that's just more for fun, sort of zipping around. And then just generally sort of photography and, you know, like taking snaps when we're on holiday and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I've used it for helping with anti-rhino poaching.
Okay.
And I also work quite a bit with the local community policing group in Palette and the neighborhood watch, and we've used the drone at night if there's a security incident and that sort of thing.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool. I've watched some of those drone racing videos on YouTube.
They're crazy.
It's insane.
Yeah,
absolutely insane the way they've. I think I watched one where they were racing drones around a sports stadium.
Yeah,
hugging the edge of the stadium as they went around. Unbelievable. So, Ricardo, you started tinkering with Bitcoin in 2011.
Yeah.
Why and what did you learn and what was your involvement in those early days?
So, I mean, in those early days when Bitcoin was young and we didn't really know what we were doing, a lot of my involvement was like, oh, this is interesting, this is a cool new thing, but I don't really believe that it's possible. You know, you sort of look at the consensus mechanism at the beginning, especially as a developer, as a technical person, and you go, well, that sounds interesting, but I think it can be broken. This is not the approach that everyone takes, but as a technical person, that's kind of like the approach to any system. You know, you go, oh, that's a cool new feature of the software, but I can break it. And I think that I can break it idea really carried through to my initial exposure to Bitcoin. And I did try and break it. I was very interested in Sybil attacking the network. I was very interested in how nodes achieved consensus between their peers. I had a very weak understanding of the Nakamoto consensus mechanism, and our proof of work played a role in that. Obviously, it's much better now. But at the time, due to a weak understanding of that, I thought, well, you know, what if I sort of like had the super majority of peers in the network connected to a particular node, and I fed it bad blocks. And now I have a much stronger understanding, but at the time it was really about trying to break Bitcoin. And through that process, I proved not only Bitcoin's robustness, but the robustness of Nakamoto consensus in general, and that gave me confidence in Bitcoin as a system and as an evolving network.
Okay. So during this time, if I'm correct, you launched a company called Globi, which is a multi-currency payment processor. Tell us a bit about that.
Sure. So one of my early things that I started doing with Bitcoin was mining. Hated it because it was really like deeply problematic in South Africa, especially where our electricity grid has not always been that stable. And electricity is, frankly, not that cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got very involved in building like tools for miners and utilities because I sort of thought, well, you know, if mining is going to be a thing globally, then I want to be the guy who's selling spades and pickaxes to miners. And in that process, I found that there were a bunch of miners, especially like late 2012, early 2013. There were miners who were mining alternative cryptocurrencies to Bitcoin. And they wanted to buy stuff from me, but they wanted to pay in Litecoin or whatever, and Feathercoin and whatnot. And I was like, well, sorry, I only accept Bitcoin or PayPal. And that was very frustrating to them, very frustrating to me. So towards the end of 2013, I started thinking about, you know, end-to-end payment rails, really just sort of going like, okay, like what if we had a payment processor that could accept anything? And settle in pretty much anything, and it did all the conversion in between, then I could accept anything and I wouldn't need to care. And that was really where it started. So Globi grew out of that, and it was started by myself, an Austrian guy called Stefan, and Raymond Prince, my head of operations. And we built Globi from that gem, from that idea, and into the company that it is today, where we ingest multitudes of cryptocurrencies, and we provide settlement in fiat currencies, in Bitcoin, in Monero. And we provide all the digital payments for Purism, the laptop manufacturer. We provide digital payments for the e-commerce stores for Mariah Carey, the Backstreet Boys, Slayer, Train. So, you know, we've gotten quite big, relatively speaking, in the global space. We're one of three payment gateways that are that support cryptocurrencies that are on Shopify. We've done pretty well. We haven't really been exposed much to the South African market, partly because our initial target market has been customers overseas that I've had a nascent relationship with or were exposed to during business development, but also because I think the cryptocurrency scene from a merchant acceptance perspective in South Africa is still very new.
Mm. All right. So is it almost like a PayPal for cryptocurrencies?
Absolutely. So it's like a PayPal for cryptocurrencies. We're expanding to be able to ingest other things. So ultimately, as a merchant shouldn't care what the user pays in. Mm. The user pays with PayPal, credit card, Bitcoin, Litecoin, Monero, whatever, Venmo, SnapScan, Zapper. Like, as a merchant, I shouldn't care. But I do care how I'm settled. And so one of the things that we provide on the settlement side, for example, is the ability to say, look, I want to have 85% come into my bank account, and I want 10% in Bitcoin and 5% in Monero. And it does that split automatically. So that's become quite powerful because merchants are using that as a way to invest in cryptocurrencies and to sort of put a little bit of money aside automatically off the top of their revenue without needing to think about it.
Mm. Fascinating. We're going to be talking in a separate podcast more about Globee, but let's talk a bit about Monero now. How did that project get started? What is Monero exactly? And what are the origins of the cryptocurrency? How does it differ from Bitcoin and other crypto?
Sure. So Monero is a cryptocurrency that's very similar to Bitcoin in terms of how it works. You know, it's proof of work. It's got blocks. It's got transactions of inputs and outputs. Those are all familiar things to anyone who's delved into Bitcoin technically. It's not based on Bitcoin's code. So it's not that someone went and clicked fork and forked Bitcoin and then patted themselves on the back for a job well done, which is kind of the lazy way to create a cryptocurrency nowadays. So it is a completely separate code base. It wasn't started by myself. The white paper was written by a guy called Nicholas von Saberhagen. No one knows who he is. It's a pseudonym.
A bit like Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yes, a little bit like Satoshi. And similarly, the guy who actually launched it is a guy called Thankful for Today. That was his username on the forum.
Yeah.
Again, nobody knows who he is. Nicholas von Saberhagen hasn't really popped up since. And
what is it about these guys inventing these things?
I don't know. I don't know. It's good though. You know, I mean, I think it's good that they. It's good to put something out into the world and then sort of step back from it. Mm. And I think there's a lot of power in being an anonymous founder of a project like that. I didn't realize it until about a year ago. But you know, when you're a founder of a project and your name is on the thing, you become a target. So you know, when like people want to go target Thankful for Today, they can't even figure out who he is, and they want to go target Satoshi Nakamoto, they can't figure out who he is. So that's very powerful. At any rate, so Monero launched in April 2014, and Thankful for Today initially was he was like a benevolent dictator of sorts. Did a fairly good job for the first few weeks, and then had like a couple of really weird ideas that the community disagreed with. And there was this pushback from the community, and he sort of said, well, I don't really care about you guys. I'm going to do this anyway. And so myself and six others decided, well, that's not really how a project should be run. It should be driven by the community, not driven by the overlords at the top. And so we forked the project away from him. We forked the code base away from him. And the community, they now had the option of two implementations, his or ours. And the community chose to use ours. And so they lived in parallel for about 6 months, and then he eventually just dropped off and stopped updating his, and we became the dominant implementation for Monero.
How did your implementation win?
I think just by pure community support.
Okay.
We're stewards of the project, but we're placed in that position in that position of relative authority by the community, and we're very cognizant of the fact that our stewardship is sort of a limited handout, and I think that that relationship that we have with the community is very different to the relationship he had.
All right. So Monero focuses very heavily on privacy.
Yes.
And I've heard it described as a truly anonymous cryptocurrency. Why is that important? Is there a philosophy behind it?
Well, okay, so first, just to clarify, there's no such thing as truly anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
I hate that term.
All right.
Because privacy is very nuanced. As an example, let's say there was something that was a cryptocurrency that was truly anonymous, and you used it for all, and every transaction was magically anonymous, but then you went and posted all your transaction details on Facebook. Is it still truly anonymous? It's not, because, you know, through your own bad OPSEC, you're leaking your transaction data. So privacy is an incredibly nuanced thing. The issue that we have today is people typically have no privacy at all, as we've seen with things like the Cambridge Analytica Facebook issue. As we've seen with many of the leaks that have happened in South Africa, where government departments and organizations with large caches of data have done a very, very poor job of protecting it. People ultimately have exposed all of their data to these organizations, and this has led to their data being out in the wild. Now, Monero, as a pro-privacy project, seeks to change that. It's sort of like, well, when you're transacting, why should that transaction data be given to hundreds of organizations? And as an example of where that actually happens, thanks to a lot of the legislation in the EU, we actually know what happens in the EU when you use PayPal. There's a report that somebody put out a couple of months ago that showed that when you transact using PayPal, your data is shared with 600 companies, which is massive.
Mm.
Now, honestly, I'm not that fussed about the stuff I buy with PayPal, but I don't really want 600 companies knowing everything I purchase. That just seems like an unnecessary amount of information floating around about me and about the Lego I buy on eBay. And the problem is that a lot of people will then go, the sort of natural response to that is, well, I've got nothing to hide. To which I say, well, you know, do you mind giving me the last 6 months of bank statements? Mm-hmm. You know, it's, do you mind publishing those online if you've got nothing to hide? And most people have a problem with that. I think everyone has a problem with that. Because even though we say we've got nothing to hide, the reality is we don't really want everyone knowing our stuff. We don't really want everyone knowing how much we earn, what we spend on our car, what we spend on our insurance, what we buy. And the threat model there is we're not concerned. I don't think people generally are concerned so much about the governments knowing that. You know, I mean, like at the end of the day, you live in a country where the government is the ruling authority and, you know, you sort of agree to generally follow their rules. The issue is, do we really want targeted advertising? You know, do we want organizations knowing what we spend our money on such that they can feed us targeted adverts? Similarly, what about criminals? Do we want criminals knowing how much money we have and what we're buying? Do we want criminals being able to know, oh, Ricardo just bought a new TV. Great. Now I know I can go steal it from him. I mean, these are all things that are deeply concerning to us as individuals, and yet we take very few steps to protect our privacy. So Monero exists for that reason, to help people protect their privacy as a natural course of using the software. Obviously, it's not perfect. It's not able to defend against people going and blurting on Twitter that they just bought a new TV, but it is able to provide a reasonable defense.
Sure. Okay. So was that the real underlying ideology, for want of a better term, behind the creation of Monero?
I mean, I'll never really know what the ideology was behind the creation of Monero, but I can tell you as developers and as stewards, our main focus is on providing default privacy to all users, maximal default privacy to all users, so that we help users avoid making mistakes. Because here's the reality, right? The reality is that you don't need Monero to be private. You can transact privately without Monero, but it requires a great deal of technical competency, a great deal of planning, forethought, You might need to have a whole bunch of organizations set up in weird countries all over the world, and then you can go, well, now I can transact privately and no one knows what I'm doing. But that's not feasible for 99.9% of the population. So what we're doing is we're saying, look, for the greatest part of the population, we can provide a reasonable level of privacy, and that's really the goal of the project.
Just take us, Ricardo, if you don't mind, through the privacy aspects of how this actually works. I assume the transactions are being stored in a ledger.
Yeah.
But please take us through how you protect privacy.
Sure. Monero focuses on four things. The first thing it focuses on is protecting against seeing where a transaction is coming from. So we use something called ring signatures. We consider this one of the weakest aspects of Monero's privacy, because basically every transaction appears to be spending seven or more old transactions on the blockchain, on the ledger. The problem is that in picking those old transactions that you're going to create the ring signature from, that that process of picking them is kind of difficult, because you could just pick them across the ledger, but statistically speaking, people tend to receive funds and spend them pretty quickly. So we've had to wait it to pick a whole bunch of newer transactions to try and mimic people's natural spending habits. And that's an area where we're, well, I mean, all areas of privacy in Monero are constantly being improved, but that's an area of particular focus, because obviously if you can trace transactions through the blockchain, you might be able to link a newer one to an older one that is on an exchange, for example, and then you can go and query and ask the exchange for, you know, whose transaction was this. Second aspect is where transactions are going to. This is a much stronger privacy scheme that we use. We use something called stealth addresses. And basically, in Bitcoin, if you look at a transaction, you can see the actual Bitcoin address that was paid. In Monero, you see this destination, but the destination has got no bearing on the address. And if within the same transaction even, multiple outputs have gone to the same address, you wouldn't be able to tell, because they all appear to be going to different destinations. The third thing that we focus on is amounts. And again, this is a similarly strong privacy claim. We use something called confidential transactions, which is something that was created by Gregory Maxwell. And we've created our own scheme based off of that called RingCT. So it combines confidential transactions with ring signatures. And that obscures the amounts such that, again, when you're looking at a Monero transaction, you can't tell what the amount is. It's this thing called a cryptographic commitment, and you're not able to tell what that relate or what that translates to in terms of an actual number. And the fourth thing that we focus on is IP address privacy. So when you're using Monero and you broadcast a transaction, is your IP address obscured, or can somebody figure out that your Monero node was the first to broadcast that IP address? And for that, we have a project called Covery, which basically uses a hidden network like Tor to broadcast transactions. And that's something that's still in progress and hasn't been deployed live yet. But honestly, IP address tracing is kind of difficult with the Monero network as is. So it's really more about that all-around defense, which is something we need to get to.
Yeah. Have you had any pushback from regulators and law enforcement agencies?
You know, I think, like, yes and no. I mean, there are some regulators who go, like, all encryption is bad, right. You know, and encryption is sort of the spawn of the devil, and you would only ever use encryption to hide something when you're doing something that's bad. To which I always say, like, well, that's the same argument for why kitchen knives shouldn't exist, because kitchen knives can also be used for bad things. The reality is, a lot of law enforcement agencies and a lot of regulators use encryption in their daily lives, and they don't even realize it. And Monero is just a way of encrypting transactions. So it's nothing unusual. It might be unusual in terms of there being very few tools that provide this, but it's not unusual in terms of privacy being something that regulators, especially in Europe, realize is important. I mean, at the end of the day, if you have large organizations, they need to be able to hide their chain, their logistics chain, they need to be able to hide their supply chain. If any of that information becomes public, then it can be deeply problematic to their business and might even be detrimental to their business.
So just last question on that particular subject. If Monero is used by the bad guys to do something, do the law enforcement agencies have any recourse? Are they able to have any insight into the network to see what happened?
They've got about as much insight into the network as they do into cash. You know, I mean, if cash is used for bad things, like, what do they do?
Hmm.
They have to rely on good old-fashioned police work. You know, they have to go and, like, knock on someone's door, kick in the door, whatever, and go and check the guy's house. They can't just rely on, well, we checked his bank account.
Yeah.
And let's be honest. If bad guys are going to do something bad, they're going to transact and do something bad, they're not going to, like, swipe their credit card. You know, there's no bad guy on the street corner saying, like, well, you know, I'll do something bad for you. Here's my Zapper QR code. Please scan it.
Hmm.
Like, they're using cash. They're using other liquid assets like gold and diamonds. And, you know, I guess some of them are slowly starting to use Bitcoin and Monero and other cryptocurrencies. But the dominant method of payment amongst criminals remains cash.
Yeah. So where do you see Monero going? What's the ultimate goal?
The ultimate goal? That's a good question. I think the ultimate goal of Monero is to be the dominant pro-privacy transactional project. Okay, that sentence sounded a bit weird, but you get what I'm saying.
Sure.
The thing is, privacy projects tend towards monopolies. And the reason is, you want to have the maximal privacy set with a project. So in other words, if you only have 100 people using a particular project, it doesn't matter how good the privacy is, your privacy set is still only 100 people. So I look at that and I'm like, okay, like what I really want is I want to be involved, or I want to use a tool where there are 100,000 people or 1 million people or 1 billion people. And that's really what Monero is trying to accomplish is, let's have as many users as possible. So that makes up for any weakness in the privacy scheme because people are able to go, well, it doesn't matter that this area is a tiny little bit weak because overall I'm part of a maximal privacy set, and that's really powerful.
Great. Naveen Jain is here as well. Naveen, maybe I could bring you in at this point. You and Ricardo have co-founded, and I'm looking at the press release here, knowing very little about it at this stage, a new open source blockchain protocol called Tari. Naveen, tell me a bit about yourself, first of all. You're American, right?
I am American. Mm-hmm. That is true. So I was born in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and I've been an entrepreneur since I was 19 years old. So I started my first company building websites in the San Francisco Bay Area, and went on to start working in the music industry. So I started running all the websites and fan clubs and online stores for artists like Linkin Park and Nine Inch Nails and Tim McGraw and Carrie Underwood and Slipknot and many others. And so I built a very strong reputation around being able to deliver really great online experiences on behalf of a very high profile artists. So then I got involved in building logistics businesses. So I also built a logistics business in the Atlanta, Georgia area that's been pretty successful. And I became an angel investor. I'm an investor in nearly 40 companies.
Oh, wow.
And I got involved in cryptocurrencies as a miner for Monero. And that's how I got connected with Ricardo.
Okay. So you met in an online forum somewhere, did you?
We met on a message board. No, I'm kidding. we were introduced by mutual friends.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Okay. So tell me a bit about Tari. What is it exactly? How did it come about, and what problem is it trying to solve?
Yeah, sure. So one of the major challenges that we see in the blockchain space is how do you apply this incredible technology to real-world problems? And growing up in the music business, I learned a lot about ticketing, and I learned a lot about also the video game industry and other entertainment-related industries. And there's some real challenges around these things called digital assets. So what are digital assets? So digital assets are things like concert tickets, loyalty points, virtual goods and games. These are examples of digital assets. And a very common problem that exists around digital assets is the people that actually issue these digital assets. So for example, in a ticketing context, that'd be like a promoter or an artist or some combination. They set rules around their digital assets that they really aren't able to enforce. So for example, a promoter may say, oh, I really don't want my tickets to be resold. But once they sell the ticket to somebody, they're unable to enforce the rule. A video game publisher might say, oh, I want to issue this in-game item that has a lot of power, but I don't want that to be resold either for a certain period of time. And then ultimately there's a thriving black market that's created, you know, where people try to game the system. And so we think that digital assets are actually a really good use case for blockchain-oriented systems. And so TARI is a digital assets-focused protocol. We're building a protocol on top of Monero that's built, purpose-built for digital asset use cases. So what does that mean for issuers and what does that mean for consumers? So for issuers, that means that now you can set rules around your digital assets and you can trust that they will actually be enforced. So for example, back to the ticketing use case, if you're a promoter or an artist or a venue or a sports team, you can say, oh, every time my tickets are resold, I want 20% of the revenue that's generated. So now you actually can participate directly in the secondary market for your tickets. Well, it turns out that the secondary market for tickets is a $15 billion industry worldwide. And the original economic participants in the sale of a ticket don't directly benefit from this massive market. Or in the video game industry, same exact thing. You know, you're working so hard to manage all of your game mechanics for, you know, these very complex video games that publishers put out there in the world. And now you can do the exact same thing. You can say, oh, you know what? This asset, this item in the game really can't be sold for 3 days or for a week or whatever it is. And oh, by the way, when it's resold, I want a percentage of the revenue too. So now you can participate even in a greater fashion in what's happening with your digital assets. And you can really retain the control that you want. So that's the benefit to a business. What's the benefit to a consumer? Well, oftentimes digital assets for consumers are a nightmare user experience, right? So you have these silos, these walled gardens. So, oh, I can only interact with in-game items for this particular video game if I participate in this publisher's walled garden, their silo. Or in the ticketing use case, maybe you have to pay exorbitant fees. You know, when I buy a ticket on a system like StubHub, I'm charged 25% fee, which is split between the buyer and seller. So the fees are exorbitant. So you have this really significant amount of friction, really significant amount of cost associated with engaging with digital assets that people love. Like, people are really passionate about these things. So we think creating a open source, decentralized, distributed protocol like TARI solves problems not only for business owners, but also solves massive problems for consumers.
Very interesting. When is this launching officially? When will people be able to start using it?
So building protocols is really difficult. Mm-hmm. So we don't have an official launch date as of now, but
right.
We're building an incredible team here in Johannesburg to build this vision, right? So and the team, as you know, is myself, Ricardo, and then we actually have a third co-founder, a guy named Dan Turee, who's also an American entrepreneur. And Dan has an incredible background in the ticketing space. He actually built a company called Ticketfly and sold it to Pandora in the U.S. for $450 million.
Cool.
So we have a really all-star team, and we're building an incredible team here in Johannesburg to make the TARI vision a reality.
Why Johannesburg?
So actually, we think that, number one, there's incredible talent here in Johannesburg. It's really just amazing, the quality of the developers you can find here. And, you know, I grew up in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So I've met lots of incredible developers throughout my career working in Silicon Valley. But I've been really impressed with the developer talent that I've met here so far in Johannesburg. Obviously, Ricardo is based here.
Yes.
So, you know, Ricardo is, you know, an incredibly important part of the TARI vision. And he's a co-founder. And he really has such a deep understanding of blockchain systems.
Yeah.
So it's really important to have someone like Ricardo leading the charge in terms of the development of a system like TARI. And we think it's a great opportunity for South Africa, you know, for something like this to be developed here versus, you know, other areas in the world. So we think that's an incredible opportunity, both for ourselves in terms of building a great team, but also for the country.
Okay. Is this being self-funded by the co-founders, or are you raising venture capital?
So we're actually backed by some of the highest profile venture capital firms in the world. So our investors include venture capital firms like Redpoint, Trinity, Canaan, Blockchain Capital, Pantera. I mean, some of these venture capital firms are really iconic. So, for example, Redpoint was one of the first investors in Netflix, for example. Mm. So, you know, we're very, very lucky to have the support of investors with this high profile and this caliber. And that just, you know, really helps us in terms of developing and executing on the Tari vision.
What sort of size team are you going to have here in Johannesburg?
So initially, we want to build a team of close to 30 people.
Oh, wow.
Here in Johannesburg, here in Woodlands.
Mostly developers?
Mostly developers.
What's the revenue model down the line?
So very interesting question. So when you're building a blockchain system, you know, it's not like building a traditional business. The goal is not to necessarily benefit shareholders like in a traditional C corporation like what we have in the U.S. The goal is actually to build a community and to build an ecosystem around this open source software. All of our software is going to be open source using a highly permissible license. So anyone can actually take the software, frankly, do whatever they want with it. So the only way that we will actually be successful is by creating an ecosystem around Tari, engaging with business owners, people that issue digital assets, engaging with consumers, getting them really excited about this new world that we want to create around how people issue and manage and transfer their digital assets. And we do that by really being as transparent as we can, engaging with open source communities in any way that we can, engaging with the business owners in any way that we can to show them how they can actually benefit from a system like this. And then, you know, along the way we win is some portion of this new economy comes to us as an organization. So we do have a percentage of the overall economy, the Tari economy, that comes to us. So, but there is no classic revenue model. We're not charging fees. We're not charging rents. We really are only winning when the network actually succeeds.
Right. So, Naveen, before we wrap up, tell me why you're building this on top of Monero.
So Monero is a really fascinating cryptocurrency. It's privacy-focused. But one of the things that's really interesting about Monero is that it actually is one of the most decentralized cryptocurrencies in the world. And the reason why is because it uses a hashing algorithm that's actually ASIC-resistant. But also the
That's what?
ASIC-resistant.
What does that mean?
So application-specific integrated circuit. So basically it's custom silicon that's purpose-built for one purpose. So in this case, for example, there's ASICs just for mining Bitcoins. So Monero employs technology that is actually ASIC-resistant. But in addition to that, the community around Monero is actually ideologically ASIC-resistant. So what that means is that anyone can really be a miner for Monero. You could use your laptop, your everyday computer to mine Monero. You don't need custom silicon. The net result of that is that Monero happens to be more decentralized. There are more people all over the world, everyday people, who are participating in the network. So that's something we think is really, really interesting about Monero. We also really strongly believe in privacy. We think privacy is a basic human right. And so that sort of fundamental ideology around Monero we think is really important. And so we really believe very strongly on that. And Monero has a very strong network. It's a very secure network. So we're really leveraging the security model of Monero. And that's the final reason why we think Monero is really compelling.
Great. Well, we are out of time. Naveen Jain is a U.S. entrepreneur and angel investor and co-founder of Tari. And Ricardo Spagni is lead maintainer of Monero and also co-founder of Tari. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you very much for having us.